Hello again, ladies and gentlemen. This is Brian McClanahan, and today we're going to talk about the Middle Colonies and the Quakers. And so we've had a discussion of the South and the Southern colonies, most importantly Virginia, and we talked about how Southern culture was in fact formed by a mixture of Cavalier culture, Celtic culture, and then later African culture. And of course, I didn't go into detail about African culture, but I did spend quite a bit of time on Cavalier and Celtic culture. So this cultural difference is important. When you start looking at the sectional differences between the North and the South, it's oftentimes too easy to just say it was economics or it was slavery. In fact, the differences between the North and the South are deep-rooted. They go all the way back to the colonial period. And if we start looking at the United States in that way, we can start dispelling this myth that the United States are one people. Now, of course, you look at culturally, there are a lot of similarities. But there are a tremendous number of differences, and Northerners and Southerners never saw eye to eye from the colonial period forward. So this conflict that will eventually result in war in 1861 is by no means something that just happens out of thin air. It's a cultural conflict. It's a political economic conflict, and slavery is part of that, but there are deeper roots than just the issue, in so many ways, the rhetorical issue of slavery, as we get later on in this course. And I discussed that in the presentations leading up to the war. So today we're going to talk about the Quakers and the Middle Colonies. And when I talk about the Middle Colonies, I'm talking about Delaware, New Jersey, New York, and Pennsylvania. And the Middle Colonies are different from the Deep North or the Northeast when you're talking about New England, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and New Hampshire. And the reason they're different is because the Middle Colonies, or the Southern Colonies too, when we look at, of course, Virginia, Maryland, the Carolinas, and Georgia. The reason they're different is because these colonies, principally New York and Pennsylvania, in so many ways, were actually founded by the Swedes and the Dutch first. So they have a little different cultural flavor. And then ultimately, the dominant culture in this Mid-Atlantic region will be the Quakers. Now, New York and Pennsylvania both claim that they are the hub of the Mid-Atlantic region. And both would have some leg to stand on, or at least one leg to stand on in each case. So we're going to talk about both those colonies in a little bit of detail. And they are very important, even leading up to the ratification of the Constitution, for example. If neither New York or Pennsylvania had supported the document, there might have been some problems there. And of course, there was a lot of opposition to it in both New York and Pennsylvania, along with the other powerful colonies of Massachusetts and Virginia. So those four colonies are the most important. And so in this Mid-Atlantic region, we have two of those colonies, New York and Pennsylvania. Now, when I mentioned that these colonies were originally founded by the Swedes and Dutch first, the most important guy in that process is a man named Peter Minuit. Now, he was the director of what was called New Netherland. He actually bought New Amsterdam, which is now present-day New York City, from the Lenape tribe for around 1,000 current dollars. And a lot of times people have said this was a great swindle. Minuit stole this land from the Indians. Well, if you look at the trade that was made and the value of the goods, these were things that the Lenape could use. He wasn't necessarily stealing this land at the time. This was seen as a very fair trade. So this perception that the Dutch or a white settler stole this land from the Indians for trinkets and beads, well, I mean, it's not necessarily accurate. They also traded things like tools, things that the Lenape could use that they didn't have. So this was, at the time, seen as something that was not one-sided at all. Minuit also helped settle New Sweden, which is present-day Delaware, near Wilmington, Delaware. So he helps found New Netherland for the Dutch, and also New Amsterdam for the Dutch, and then later on he helps found New Sweden. So New York is going to develop initially as a Dutch colony. And there are some interesting components to that. First of all, the Dutch institute something called patroonships. Now, a patroonship essentially was a state. And this estate was very much like your own country, a feudal estate. In fact, if you were a patroon, you controlled the taxes, the laws, everything in your particular patroonship. So you were a king, essentially, in your own country, your own estate. So in so many ways, New York develops kind of like the South. All along the Hudson River, you're going to have these patroonships. And even up until the 1860s, New York City was very much tied to the South. In fact, the South called New York City a sister city. And they were disappointed that New York, at least New York City, didn't side with the South in that war. And there were a number of people in New York who didn't favor the war. In fact, New York was really a hotbed of opposition to the war. And there was talk about New York actually seceding, New York City actually seceding from New York during the war itself and becoming an independent city, a free city. So New York had long developed in a way that was very similar to the South, in that it was a conservative area. It had these patroon ships, which were estates. It was a very independent region, particularly when the English took over this region in the 1660s. So New York has, again, a little different cultural flavor to it. Now, how did it become part of the English or the British North American colonies eventually? Well, New York was lost by the Dutch to the English in the Second Anglo-Dutch War of 1664. New Amsterdam will be renamed New York City, and New Netherland, New York. Now, where did they get the name New York? Well, the king's brother was named James, Duke of York, so later King James II. So it was natural that these colonies would be named after him. So we already had, you know, Jamestown in Virginia. Of course, that was after their father. Duke of York, of course, I'm sorry, named after their grandfather. James Duke of York was, in 1664, was the brother of the King of England, King Charles II. So that's how we get New York. Now, the Peace of Breda gave New Netherland, which is the peace treaty that ended this Anglo-Dutch War, gave New Netherland to the English. So the Dutch are actually out of North America by 1664. In the process of acquiring New York, the English also acquire New Jersey. So this was also ceded to the English by the Peace of Breda in 1664. And New Jersey is very similar to New York in that it is largely agricultural. It follows a southern pattern of development in so many ways. In fact, the colonial charter for New Jersey is very similar to that of the Carolinas. So you have, at least in theory, the establishment of plantation agriculture in New Jersey. You know, large estates are formed. It's a cavalier colony, at least, again, in theory. But there are other people here, of course, in New Jersey who aren't going to be cavaliers, the Quakers, most importantly. But in theory, New Jersey is going to be very much like the South. And in fact, when you get into the 1860s, there was a large number of New Jersey citizens who did not support the war with the South, who were more Southern in their outlook. In fact, Southern New Jersey was in so many ways an area that was a hotbed of opposition to the Republican Party and the Lincoln administration. So you still have this old flavor to New Jersey that was not like the North. It was more like the South. So you had that in New York State, and then you had that in New York and New Jersey later on. Of course, both these colonies are very important colonies, at least New York is, as we move forward in the colonial period. Another interesting thing about New York, when you talk about states' rights later on, when we get to the War of 1812, the New York militia refused to attack into Canada because they were defending New York State. They were not part of a national army, so to speak. So it's not uncommon in the colonial period, then into the early federal period, to see members of these states thinking that their state is their country, not the United States, and very much being a part of the states' rights atmosphere in the United States. New Jersey was actually East and West Jersey under proprietary control until 1702, when then it would be made a royal colony. So Jersey, New Jersey, was a proprietary colony for about 50 years, and then, of course, it would become a royal colony. Now, the other colony, little colony in this particular part of the country, in the Mid-Atlantic region, was Delaware. Now, Delaware was settled by the Dutch in 1631 at Zwanendael, which is present-day Lewis, Delaware. And if you look at a map of Delaware, Delaware makes a little hook, and you have the Delaware Bay, and that's where Zwanendael is, right in that little hook on the Delaware Bay. Of course, Zwanendael would be destroyed very shortly, and then Wilmington would be settled by the Swedes in 1638. It was retaken by the Dutch in 1665, but then again ceded to the English at the Peace of Breda. Now, at this point, It's given in 1682 to William Penn, and it becomes known as the Lower Counties on the Delaware. So for a very long period of time, for almost, almost 100 years, Delaware is considered part of Pennsylvania. And what's interesting about Delaware is Delaware actually secedes from Pennsylvania and the British Empire in 1776. June 15, 1776, the Delawareans will declare their independence not only from Pennsylvania, but also from England and Great Britain. So Delaware, in fact, becomes one of the first states to secede from the British Empire and the first state to secede from another colony and become a state itself. So Delaware has a very independent streak. Now, Delaware is only three counties. It's a very small colony. But again, Delaware was very much like the South. In fact, the South considered it part of its sister states all the way up until 1861. In fact, there's a secession banner that was produced in Charleston in 1860, and Delaware was part of that secession banner. Now, Delaware was a slaveholding state, though by 1860, slavery had very much practically disappeared in Delaware. The largest slaveholder only had just a few slaves, but Delaware was an agricultural state. And of course, you had Wilmington, which was a growing industrial city. The DuPont family was very powerful in Delaware, and so they're going to have a tremendous impact on the northern part of the state, up near Pennsylvania and Philadelphia. But the rest of the state was very agricultural and very much like the South. You are going to have a Quaker influence in Delaware in some parts of the state, but again, very aristocratic state, very conservative state. Now, let's talk about the Quakers. And the Quakers are important for our discussion of Pennsylvania. In fact, the Quakers at one time were called the Society of Friends. I mean, that's what they were known as. They're going to settle in Delaware, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Maryland. And if you're looking at any group that would come to the New World to escape religious persecution, well, this would be it. And they are coming here also to form new societies. So they're very much part of that northern position, not just recreating English society. They're here to establish new societies and to escape religious persecution. Again, very northern in that way. Whereas the South is really looking to recreate this English aristocratic lifestyle, Pennsylvania is going to be a lot different. In fact, William Penn said that he wanted to show Quakerism at work freed from hampering conditions. So the Quakers were continually harassed, were persecuted. In fact, they had something called the Books of Sufferings. It was an honor to be persecuted if you were a Quaker, because that meant that you were suffering for your religion. Now, they called God a God of love and light, and that was important. The inner light was important. So when we start talking about Quaker culture, you've got to keep this inner light in mind. God of love and light and inner light. They believed in strong communities, basic literacy, equality of manners, simplicity of taste, and the importance of family. And most Quakers are going to come from Germany and northern England. Now, the most important Quaker, of course, is William Penn. He's the founder of Pennsylvania, or Penn's Woods. Now, Penn was from an old aristocratic family. In fact, he fought in this Anglo-Dutch War, but later on he will become a Quaker, which means he has to renounce all of his aristocratic ties. The Quakers are anti-war. They're pacifists, so he gives up that part of his life. He becomes, in so many ways, impoverished at one point, even though his family is very wealthy. But his connections through his family is how he's going to acquire this colony. Pennsylvania, of course, would also control parts of New Jersey as well as Pennsylvania, modern Pennsylvania, and Delaware. This was a proprietary colony, and the Penns controlled it all the way up until American War for Independence. Penn believed in balanced government, though, and religious freedom, of course, and civil liberties. In fact, if you look at the Quakers, this is the most civil libertarian group, at least outwardly, that you'll find. Now, of course, in Quaker society itself, if you were a Quaker, you had to follow strict rules, but what they required of their people, they did not require of anyone living around them. And in fact, they were very interested in what they called reciprocal liberty. So we'll see. I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But when you look at speech, you know, again, this is part of a culture. And the Quakers were famous for what was called Midland speech. It was very muscular. It was bluff, literal, direct, forceful, vivid. And if you look at the Mid-Atlantic region today, that's what you're going to get. I mean, people will tell you, well, if you're in Pennsylvania or New York, you know, this is a very plain-spoken area. They tell you what they think. They're very direct. And that's part of Quaker culture. They were the same way. Many Quaker words also have been absorbed into the American lexicon. Things like brat and crib and dresser and guts, guzzle, mad, sick, nap. All these things are part of Quaker language. So, in that way, the Quakers have become very much a part of what we consider an American culture today. Again, Pennsylvania could call itself the hub of this region, maybe New York, but this culture was very dominant in this mid-Atlantic region. When it came to marriage, the Quakers viewed marriage as a loving agreement. Quakers, though, could not marry non-Quakers. But love did not mean romantic attraction or sexual passion or domestic affection. This was a union of sweethearts, and love must precede marriage. So it was a little different than what you would have, say, in the Cavalier Society, where marriages would often be arranged, or in Celtic society, where there was abductions going on. Of course, in Puritan society, marriage was a civil contract. Here, love was important, but what they very much viewed marriage as is kind of a union of best friends. And so that idea of marriage, of course, has kind of gone down the line into our modern conception of marriage. So the Quakers were very important in that as well. Child rearing. The Quakers believed that you should brace the will. Children were seen as harmless, righteous, and innocent creatures. So many families were actually child-centered. The children can sometimes dominate a family. And again, this view of childhood, for the most part, with some modifications, of course, whether in the North or the South, has carried over into modern American society. Modern American society has become very much child-centered. And this is coming straight out of Quakerism. So if you look at the way that we see America today, the Quakers are very important for that cultural aspect of it. Social values are very important for children. So the Quakers considered socialization an important part of childhood. And again, this has become part of our American ideal. We need to socialize children, get them out and socialize with other children. Now, there is a slight difference in this. Today, when we talk about socializing children, we're looking at sending them to public schools oftentimes or into schools and communities where you don't often know who your children are associating with, you don't know the families, you don't know their religious background, their cultural background, etc., etc. Well, in Quaker society, socialization was important because everyone was a Quaker, so everyone knew what these other families were going to be doing because they all had the same culture and the same cultural background and the same values and ideals. So socialization was important in that way, but I think the Quakers would have looked at a modern American society with its emphasis on socialization and getting people together who don't often have the same cultural ideas, religious ideas, etc., etc., and they would have looked at that as dangerous for their own children. So socialization was important in a contained culture, not necessarily getting people out and socializing with people who you didn't have anything in common with, didn't share the same values. In fact, if you look at Quaker culture, teenage years were the most restrictive because of hormones and other things. The teenagers tended to want to stray from this particular type of culture. So the teenagers were most restricted, not the young children. In modern America, it's kind of seen as teenage years. This is when you're starting to let children kind of feel their way, so to speak. So it's the exact opposite of what the Quakers would have been doing. In terms of religion, of course, this whole society is based on Quaker religion, and the Quakers had meetings. Now, this is in stark contrast to the Orthodox churches of the South, the Catholic Church or the Orthodox Anglican Church. It would be more akin to, say, the Congregationalist churches of New England. But the idea of a meeting was to essentially forge this cultural continuity. A Quaker service might have no speaking at all. In fact, they really didn't have any formal structure. They were held in simple meeting houses, which had to be brightly lit because of that inner light idea. But you might have singing, praying, speaking conducted all at once and not in unison. So these things could be rather chaotic. And when I say singing, Quaker music was just like their church. There was no formal structure to it. It was just the most god-awful thing you'd ever heard. They didn't have notes and formal music like we have today. I mean, this was like watching the bad auditions on American Idol. That was Quaker music. So in some ways, this was laughable, but again, the idea of a church, of a meeting in Quaker society, was to forge that cultural continuity. Foodways. It went very much into the Quaker ideal. Plain food and drink. They had very simple foodways. only eat when you're hungry, hungry only drink when you're dry. And the Quakers, in following their religion, boycotted foods that were socially evil, things like sugar. They boycotted sugar, of course, because sugar is produced on plantations. And the Quakers were abolitionists, so plantations, of course, produced slave labor, and the Quakers saw that as a problem. They boycotted salt. They boycotted salt because salt was heavily taxed, and of course, these taxes were often used to pay for wars. So they boycotted these type of things. Dyes were forbidden. Dyes were forbidden because dyes were produced on plantations, and plantations also had slave labor. So you're looking at a society that's in so many ways dedicated to the religion in ways that Americans today are not. I mean, you're boycotting foods because they're socially evil. You're boycotting dyes because they're socially evil. So this is a supreme dedication. Most Americans today are not that dedicated to the fundamental structure of their religion, but the Quakers were, and it's admirable in that way. They also ate boiled dumplings and puddings, but again, without any sugar, no salt. I mean, there's very little seasonings here. So this is a very plain society. And that's, you have to emphasize that, very plain, very, very austere. I mean, this is what you're getting out of Quaker society. Their homes are very plain, not many furnishings. They are brightly lit, but there's not a whole lot in them. They don't really show off like in Cavalier society, we had very fine furnishings. They just didn't do that kind of stuff. Work was a form of worship in Quaker society. They were encouraged industry and commerce. In fact, idleness was a deadly sin. If you look at the Puritans and the Quakers, they very much had the same work ethic, what we often call the Protestant work ethic. They considered that if you had a calling, if you were good at something, a skill, that was a calling, and that you should do that calling, do that skill well. I mean, this was your God-given skill, and so that was, if you did not do that, you were actually offending God. The thing about the Quakers is that you could trust them in their business transactions. Ethics had to be maintained at all times, which is why the Quakers were very well trusted with banks, for example. People trusted them with their money because of their religion. You couldn't always trust other people with your money, but you could trust the Quakers. So again, this religious aspect of their life was important, and people recognized that. They recognized that the Quakers had something valuable here, that you could trust these people. You could trust them because their ethics were so highly regarded. And of course, you knew that the Quakers were always going to be doing work behind the scenes. They weren't going to be lazy. I mean, idleness was a sin. You couldn't do that kind of stuff. When it came to wealth, Penn wished to distribute land equally in Quaker society, but accumulation of wealth was highly possible. Again, many banks were started by Quakers. So you had in Pennsylvania, for example, when you get later on in the colonial period, if you look at the central banking system that we have in the United States in the early federal period, of course, Quakers are not necessarily involved in this, but many of your banking institutions were in Pennsylvania. The idea of a central bank of Pennsylvania was actually floated first, and when they couldn't get that there, then they push it into the United States, and of course with Alexander Hamilton. So the Quakers in banking, if you look at banking in the United States, you have to focus on Pennsylvania in so many ways because that's where a lot of your banks were centered. And of course, wherever Quakers were, you would often have banks. They also had, though, a benevolent attitude toward the poor. Quakers were very famous for having poor houses, almshouses, orphanages, hospitals, things of this nature, because they had this idea in their religion of giving back to society. So even though wealth was accumulated in Quaker society, they always had an idea that you gave back. So in that way, this charitable element of their culture, again, was very admirable, and people admired, and people respected them for that. Finally, power and liberty. This is important. In Quaker society. In fact, if you look at the Mid-Atlantic area, and again, I talked about New York and how independent New Yorkers were. They had these patroon ships, and then later on there was talk of secession in New York in 1861. There was actually talk of secession in New York before that when you had the Essex Junto following the Louisiana Purchase, but even slightly before that too. But I mean, so New York had a very independent streak. So did Pennsylvania. In fact, politics were part of religion in Pennsylvania. These meetings were actually there to also serve political purposes. They believed in political parties. They believed in free elections. But what the Quakers also believed in was minimal government. And why they believed in minimal government is important. They believed in minimal government because that protected their religion. Minimal government was seen as a hedge to protect their culture. If you have a strong central authority, your culture is going to be endangered by that central authority. This is where, in the first discussion I had in this course, I talked about how monarchy is in no way conservative, because what the only thing monarchy and central authorities do is destroy native cultures. They destroy the local autonomy and the local cultures of the people in communities. In the name of some greater culture. So the Quakers recognized that. They recognized that the central authority, for example, in England, could be extremely hostile towards their religion. So minimal government was more important. If you're talking about keeping your culture, if you're talking about keeping your liberty, minimal government was the only way to do it. The Quakers recognized that. The Cavaliers recognized that. The Celts recognized that. And in so many ways, the Puritans recognized that, though the Puritans would be much more imperialistic in their outlook and in spreading their culture than the rest of the cultures in British North America. The Quakers also believed in what was called reciprocal liberty, meaning that every liberty that they demanded should be returned in kind. So the Quakers, of course, believed in religious freedom. In that way, they would say that everyone else should have religious freedom as well. So they're not going to suggest that they need religious freedom and you can't have it. They would say, if we're going to demand religious freedom, you can have religious freedom too. And this went on down the line. So the Quakers were in so many ways libertarians externally. Internally, they had a very harsh penal code. Their cultural continuity was very important. Quakers could not marry non-Quakers, for example. So, you know, these type of things were important. But externally, the Quakers were libertarians. One thing I didn't mention, of course, when our look at, for example, reform, the way the Quakers had a benevolent attitude towards other people. You know, when you talk about prison reform, the Quakers were always very much behind prison reform. They believed in rehabilitation rather than punishment, with certain exceptions. But when you start talking about rehabilitation in prisons today, you know, should we go out and force prisoners to work on chain gangs, or should we rehabilitate these people? The Quakers, of course, would say rehabilitation, with again certain exceptions. Most importantly, sexual crimes, which were a situation where the Quakers did not believe in rehabilitation. And that kind of idea has generally carried into American society today. So again, if you're looking at cultural impact, the Quakers had a tremendous amount of that. And when you talk about language, when you talk about child rearing, when you talk about some elements of reform, the way they looked at politics and meetings and elections, how important these things are, I mean, these were all important for the Quakers. And of course, they are libertarians. And I've given you a link to Penn's frame of government so you can look at that and see how Penn organized his colony. If you look at Pennsylvania and New York, these two hub areas, again, very much independent people. So that's going to carry forward. The thing that I want you to get out of these discussions on the colonies and Mid-Atlantic and the South is how important individual liberty was to the Quakers, how important minimal government and limited government was to these different cultures, the Cavaliers, the Celts, the Quakers. That was the American tradition, culturally, not centralization, not forcing your culture down someone's throat. That is not the American tradition. The American tradition is actually the exact opposite. So it's quite ironic that now in American society we think in centralization, in terms of the big picture, and we have to look at the central authority. Well, the Quakers, the Celts, the Cavaliers would have said, well, that's completely opposite. Our plantation is first and foremost, if you're a patroon or a Cavalier. Then our county, then our state, then our central authority. Quakers, same way. Our city was more important. Our religion was more important. Then we went up to the county, the state, and then the central authority as well. So government for these three cultures was bottom up rather than top down. And I that's the American tradition. You should take that away from the colonial periods. It's one of the most important themes you can get out of this course, is that always, always, always Americans were looking at bottom up rather than top down. It's only been in the last 150 years we start looking at it and flipping that on its head, which destroyed the Union of the Founders and destroyed the traditional American culture, so to speak, and these diverse cultures that we had. Okay, well, that's our discussion on the Quakers, and we'll pick up next time with the French.